delighted to have Mark Van Steenwyck here with us this morning. And I've asked Samantha Leoy, the pastor, the Minister of Peace and Justice for Eastern District and Franconia, to give us a more personalized introduction to Mark.
Most of you, I think, know that Mark is founder and pastor at the Mennonite Worker in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Some of you may have known about it when it was called Missio Dei. It's undergone a name change recently. I think what I appreciate a lot, I mean, as someone myself who comes from sort of outside the Mennonite fold and has come in, I appreciate that he speaks as somebody who's been attracted to Mennonite, Anabaptist Mennonite theology. And I think, as is often true, as someone who has come to it as an adult, he can see maybe more clearly than some where we need transformation and where we need to maybe be pushed. So I see Mark as somebody who invites us to live in ways that recall us to the roots of Jesus' way of living, way of being in the world, and a way which shares freely without regard for who deserves what. And kind of calling us by example, by the way that he lives and the way that his community lives, to a way of welcoming strangers into our houses as if welcoming self. But I will let Mark do any preaching that is happening today. And I just want to mention also that he does have copies of his book, which just came out in September, The Unkingdom of God. Against our better anti-capitalist impulses, we are selling that today. No, but he has some copies available, and I'm sure he'd be happy to, you know, sign it and draw you a picture and write you a poem or something inside. So we're really, really glad to have you, Mark. Thanks for coming. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here. I do have to make a disclaimer. On the back, most people think I'm wearing a clergy collar, but I'm actually just from Minnesota and my neck is pale. But it really looks, it just looks like a clergy collar. And that makes me feel awkward because Mennonites don't usually wear clergy collars. I don't think I'm not trying to set myself above other people by wearing a clergy collar. It's just that's how pale my neck is. Besides the book, our community does a little newspaper. It's kind of part of the Catholic Worker type tradition of putting out little newspapers. We have a crossword puzzle. So these, you can just take these. I have a handful of these. If you're interested in the book, $15 or whatever you have is usually. I'm the guy who's usually giving away books and feels, and then later someone else in my community chews me out because the money generally goes to help our community out. But I just, if anybody wants a copy, you can have one. I think the way I'm going to just structure the time, I'm going to share a little bit about my community, kind of give a framework. And some of this framework, I mean, we're all educated folks to varying degrees who know a little bit of what Jesus has to say about economics. But I want to just remind us of, have some kind of common structure. But then I'm aware of the fact that I live in an intentional community and we all don't live in intentional communities, right? And so the practicality of what Jubilee economics, or the kind of the economics that we see Jesus talking about, particularly in Luke and Acts, how we live into that in the complexities of our modern age is an important question. And I don't assume that everyone's going to start opening up their homes, having homeless people sleeping on their couches, and grappling with things the same way we have. But I share my story just because I feel like it's important to for us to have a way in which we're practically trying to live into this stuff. And then hopefully that kind of gives us a point of reference for maybe talking about what the larger church can do to embody an economics that brings justice. But, you know, if you know, anybody who knows me knows that I like to be self-deprecating. And I always, particularly because if you, usually when you go hear someone who is in an intentional community talk, they share kind of heroic stories, right? Where I feel bad after listening to some folks talk because they just are doing these amazing things, and then I sit and think, I'm not doing those amazing things. So as a kind of a counteracting, a subversive tactic for that, I like to share my failure stories as much as I share success stories. And so I will share one of those stories with you now. Our community, we have two community houses, Sattler House, named after Michael Sattler, and Clare House, named after Clare of Assisi, two figures that influence us in our community. And at each house, we do things a little differently, but every house has guest rooms. We do take guests in sometimes just right off the street. Usually they're referred to us, all by word of mouth. We avoid being on some list somewhere because we'll get inundated with people. And so we don't have that much hospitality to offer. So we just do by word of mouth. And we have common meals together throughout the week. And one of these meals that happens at our house is on Wednesday. And about 4 years ago, we had this guest who came to us. And it's really kind of a sad story. He got cancer. He was already HIV positive. And so the complexity of his health was such that he lost a lot of work, lost his job, lost his place to live, and came to live with us. He lived with us for about 6 months. And, you know, to be really honest, at that time in my life, I was thinking about the hospitality we were doing as me kind of winning points. Like, I thought of it as like, look, I'm doing a good thing. Yay is me. And when you think that way, then you kind of feel like you've done enough. That's the problem of starting to think that way. Like, gee, this guy should be grateful. Like, if anybody's not grateful or mean, you kind of think, well, who do they think they are? Don't they see what I'm doing for them? That kind of thinking can creep in. And so it was just a little bit of that with him, because this man was, we'll call him Don. Don was one of the sweetest guests we've ever had. He's very quiet. He's kind of the ideal house guest, because you have to go out of your way to try to say, hey, you can come downstairs now and eat. Like, it's not other guests we've had where you try to block them out because you're freaking out because they're so loud and they're taking up so much of your social space. Don was not like that. He was like almost like part of the furniture. You could ignore him if you wanted. And sometimes that's kind of what I liked. One day after a Wednesday night meal, conversation turned to like, hey, the night is young. I didn't have a five-year-old yet. Jonas wasn't even born, so it must have been about 6 years ago, I guess, at this point. So folks were like, let's go to a movie. And I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. I love going to a movie. I would love that. Now, here's the problem. In my head, I quickly calculated. I could either invite Don to go to the movie with us, or I can have enough for soda and gummy bears. But I can't do both. So I ended up going to the movie and getting the soda and the gummy bears, right? And this is like a silly little thing. Like, oh, okay, maybe he didn't want to go to a movie. It's not like it's an injustice that he didn't get to go to a movie. But I realized it dawned on me as I thought about it that I was just literally choosing gummy bears and soda over friendship with this guest who lived with us for 6 months. And I actually stayed up late that night and couldn't sleep. But it wasn't because I felt like I had stiffed Don. It's because I realized that almost every economic choice that I make beyond the things that just secure my own, you know, well-being could fall into that category. I mean, just literally choosing, I'm going to eat more gummy bears or go to the movie or any kind of thing that you think of as kind of luxurious that maybe we think we're so used to doing in our society that we don't think of it as luxury. Maybe I'll upgrade my car, from this package to this package, whatever. All these little economic choices all around me that meant that that limited my capacity to do justice or build relationships at some level. And so we began to think about this a lot as our community. We started realizing other things about how we structure our lives economically. It's not just that some of us have more and some have less. And sometimes it's obvious, like, with groceries, since we have to share food, some people eat whenever they want in our house. I hate brie. I'm more of a blue cheese man. But I can get blue cheese and then trust that maybe Marty will just eat his Velveeta slices. And I think, well, that's okay, because this is my money. When you live in a house, it's harder to think, well, why do I need this blue cheese and why can't I share? Those sorts of things start creeping in. Even worse is we've started realizing there's some of us that are the people called hosts who offer the hospitality. And then there's this other class of people who are always the guests, who are always dependent upon us. And in this transaction, somehow we always get points and they're dependent upon us. these difficult questions. Now, part of our, the way our society is structured is we believe in this thing, and it's really deep ingrained. Even if we don't agree with it on the surface, it shapes the way we think about everything, is this idea that we live in a meritocracy, that basically people who have lots of money earned it themselves, and that people who are poor didn't earn as much, or maybe they had negative meritocracy, like they earned bad things because of bad choices. And so we tend to assume that people who have money did something right, and people who don't have it did something wrong, which, I mean, there's some truth there we have to look at, but that's, I think, generally as a structural reality is not a good way of slicing how it actually works. And so when you have hear Jesus coming into the into his context, where he talks to people, especially in Luke, the way he encounters the poor and encounters the rich differently. Like, one of the questions I often get is, hey, Mark, you talk a lot about the poor. Don't you think the rich people need the gospel too? And I never know exactly what they mean by that question, because sometimes I wonder if the question is, we need to, like, don't get so tripped up on economic disparity. Everyone needs to hear the gospel the same way, and we need to build relationships the same way. But Jesus seems to engage the wealthy and the poor differently. He might have a gospel proclamation for both, which he does. But oftentimes, when he's talking to the rich, there's kind of this these other layers that have to be contended with. So, you know, the classic passage that everyone hates having read to them is, of course, the rich young ruler story. I'm just going to read that. And I know we've probably all preached on this or heard this before, but it's such a great story. It's in Luke 18 and following. Ruler asked him, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "Why do you call me good?" Jesus asked him. "No one is good but one, God. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, honor your father and mother." "I have kept all these from my youth," he said. When Jesus heard this, he told him, "You still lack one thing. Sell that you have and distribute it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." After he heard this, he became extremely sad because he was very rich. Seeing that he became sad, Jesus said, "How hard it is for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God, for it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." Those who heard this asked, "Who then can be saved?" He replied, "What is impossible with men is possible with God." It goes on from there. This is the interesting thing about this passage. I've preached on it a number of times. I don't know if I can ever remember someone coming up to me afterwards and saying, "This passage applies to me." It's amazing. Everyone assumes it doesn't apply because we do this quick mental jump. Jesus clearly knew what was hidden in his secret heart, right? This man in particular had problems with his wealth, unlike the vast other wealthy people. And so when this man comes to Jesus, and Jesus says, "Oh, you need to sell everything because I've seen into your secret heart and know that you just made an idol of your wealth, and you need to instead be one of those rich people who's just a little more generous than you are right now. And then it'll be all good. Maybe tithe better to my church." As though the rich part of him being a rich young ruler is incidental. Like, he could just as easily have been the cussing young ruler, right? Or just any, just, I don't know, the lusty young ruler, right? This guy just happens to be the rich young ruler. And then when the disciples came to Jesus afterwards, when the guy goes away sad, if he was the cussing young ruler, they could have said, "Holy shit, Jesus, who then can be saved?" Right? Because it's just incidental. But we all know the whole structure of Luke and Acts is there's this economic jubilee thing going where the wealthy, you know, it starts with Jesus' mom doing the powerful will be torn down, the low will be lifted up. You see this kind of interplay going throughout Luke and Acts. And then when it gets to Acts, then the early Acts community embodies Jesus' message of good news for the poor. They kind of live like a commune for a little while. Not, we could talk about why they're doing that, but at base level, almost everyone agrees it's because there's a lot of people who needed a place to live and needed sustenance, and so they shared. We can argue about whether or not Jesus intended for everyone to live in a hippie commune forever. I don't think that's true, but there was clearly economic redistribution based upon the gospel happening. It's also problematic that, because usually the first response is, well, Jesus only told the rich young ruler to sell everything he has and give it to the poor. He didn't say that to anybody else, except for like five chapters earlier when he told his disciples the exact same thing. Now, of course, this is going to make me feel uncomfortable if I start thinking about taking this too literally. I have a tattoo of St. Francis on my arm, but I'm not going to be ridiculous like he was about it. If we've seen the movie Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, I'm not going to strip down naked and walk off into the fields of flowers right now and then try to live at one with the poor exactly like that. I'm not sure if it's because I'm so wise as to not be reckless like St. Francis or because I lack his faith. I'm still not sure about that. But I do know that it's very clear that when Jesus is talking to the rich young ruler and then others, like you see Zacchaeus being the antithesis, the embodiment of faithful response to Jesus later on in the book of Luke, where he basically does justice and pays back everyone he's stolen from and also gives above and beyond that half of everything to the poor. Luke 4, when Jesus shows up and he gives his hometown message, the one where these people that he probably grew up with try to throw him off the cliff at the end of Luke 4, which is really awkward. Going back later, if he ever goes back to a high school reunion, he's going to feel really uncomfortable. But there's this language, and Jesus comes and says, I'm here to proclaim good news to the poor, recover sight for the blind, and he goes on to the year of the Lord's favor. Most scholars, and I think John Howard Yoder is one of the big references. He kind of was one of the first people in kind of the new era of political theology to point this out, as far as I can tell, that really that is clearly Jubilee language, that people hearing would understand that to be Jubilee. And the thing that offended them wasn't just that Jesus was proclaiming a Jubilee where those who have secured wealth in a way that would have been considered intrinsically unjust, because we know that, at least according to the vision of the Old Testament with the Jubilee laws, there was never supposed to be any individuals amassing land, right? We know that, especially in that society, but still to a lesser extent, but still true today, that we have all of our wealth in our society usually through land or labor. That's where wealth comes from. Every once in a while, someone comes up with a nifty idea and makes money off of it, but the basis of societal wealth is still land and labor. And that the Jubilee laws specifically address that. Every 7 years, if you had sold yourself into slavery, you'd be set free from that bondage. So that's a way of clearing that sort of debt. Then also, if my family sold off our family ancestral land, every Jubilee, we'd get it back so that there could be no intractable, perpetual poverty. Every family would get their chunk. And people liked that idea. Jesus talked to the peasants, and the peasants really liked that idea. The thing that offended them in Luke 4, which I'm not going to go through all of it, is that Jesus makes it very clear. First, he quotes Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah. It goes to the year of the Lord's favor. But then he stops before Yahweh starts talking about all the cans of wrath that he's going to open on the Gentiles. And so they start realizing, oh, he left off the juicy part that we like about that in their context would apply to the Romans, saying Jesus is, he's not siding with the Romans, is he? That's kind of the question they might have in their mind. So then when Jesus says later on in Luke 4, and he gives them these stories of the prophets Elijah and Elisha going to the Gentiles to do their miracles and going almost out of their way rather than doing their miracles to the Jews, the implication is clear that whatever Jubilee he's talking about includes the Gentiles, and that's why they want to throw him off the cliff at the end of that little story. So we have this, okay, so now we're in this problematic thing. It kind of makes sense to think about Jubilee within a specific land base among a specific group of people who share an ethnic heritage. They have a structure for that. But what happens when Jesus universalizes this Jubilee idea? Jesus is not an economist. We don't get any how-tos on this. We know that somehow part of the idea of what it means for us to be a church is based on this universalizing of God's favor from the Jews to the world. But we don't know how to think about that economically, or at least most of us. At least I know I struggle with that. What does that look like? So our community, in a way, the Mennonite Worker, is an experiment in trying to figure out, at least on a microcosm, what that is. Because I'm convinced that when we can get too sidetracked with the big picture and then fail to do anything specifically. Like, as an example, I have a friend who's a Marxist organizer. He does union organizing and all sorts of other stuff. He's, like, all of his Facebook pictures are him wearing red. And he has a black beret. Like, he's a Marxist. He, like, enjoys being called a commie. Like, he thinks that's a badge of honor. Like, so he's one of those really serious Marxist people. And we're always talking, he's always complaining about how the society needs to change, and I almost agree with him on everything, except for I'm an anarchist, not a Marxist, so then I get uncomfortable about strong centralized government. But we're both forms of socialists, so we can talk about economics and stuff, and it's all great. This is where it gets interesting, though. One day he comes to our house, and he had referred someone to us who had been living with us for years. And this friend of ours starts talking about how retirement is coming soon, and how he's looking forward to retiring to Costa Rica, where he's going to live it up in his elder years. And he tells our friend, who lives with us, you should come with. To which this friend says, I can't afford it. I don't have any money. I'm unemployed and was homeless when I got here. And he said, well, can't you use your Social Security income? He's like, I've never made enough money. I'm going to make $200 or something a month when I get my Social Security. So my Marxist friend shrugs and says, oh, well. So I look at him and said, you don't have to wait for the revolution to become a socialist, Dan. Right? But that little version of that conversation happens all the time. There's all sorts of people that long for this great societal change to make it better when there's possibilities for small justices around us that we overlook. We had a conversation once with a nearby church about housing justice, how the way to solve housing problems and homelessness is to make more affordable housing, which I agree with. That's true. But because of that, because they came to that conclusion, they had this church symposium where they had different folks come and talk about how to address homelessness, because they realized that systemic change needed to happen, that our approach of just offering housing to people directly is kind of just a Band-Aid and is superficial. Like, that's the way the thinking goes, right? We need to fix a big problem, so any small attempt we do is just a small thing. The problem with that is how vastly it overrides our individual humanity in the equation. And then we stop seeing what creative things we can do directly, right? Each church that we're a part of is an economic unit where the people have resources. Rarely do I encounter churches that are talking seriously about how to do that. Oftentimes I see churches that are activistic about how to deal with large, abstract social justice issues. But for us, the question is, how do we move more deeply in interpersonal ways into doing Jubilee and encourage churches around us to do likewise? For us, hospitality has been a big thing, and it's part of the worker part of the Mennonite Worker name, is that we take our cues from the Catholic Worker movement. So usually there's 20 of us living between two houses now. A third of us at any given moment are guests. The interesting thing that I get most excited about is the number of people who came as guests who are now members of our community, which means that they're committed indefinitely and that my economic future is tied up with them. We do consensus decision making. We're moving to doing a common purse, which means we're going to start by everyone puts their paycheck in. If someone doesn't have a paycheck, they won't put anything in, obviously, and then we'll all get a stipend. We find that we're able to meet each other's needs at a basic level with a little left over by all of us living simply, and it creates space for folks who would have just been in the system to participate fully in our life together. We're trying to extend that by having different households in our city offer guest rooms that we'd send, like, kind of the lower risk hospitality folks. And try to talk to churches about what are some things we can do besides having like a 1% of the budget for a Jubilee fund. Like, how do we begin to move towards some of the bigger ways that we can do Jubilee within our congregations. But as we've been trying to do this, I've encountered a number of these kind of persistent myths. And one of them I already talked about is meritocracy. So what we get all the time is there's this fear when we start talking about how we do community that somehow these homeless people are taking advantage of. That's like the big question that we get. Are you enabling homeless people by having them live with you? Is the single biggest complaint or criticism we get. Which I find fascinating because no one ever asks how wealthy people might be enabled, right? So that's not to pick on the wealthy, it's just recognizing, look, there's all sorts of systemic ways that entitlement works in our society. Why is it that when we start moralizing about economics, the poor, by and large, are the ones we moralize against? I know that now in our post-Occupy era, people are starting to get judgmental about the rich now, which I don't think that helps. It's not like we need to spread out the judgment. I think we need to look at the structures and change the structures. But still, even with the amount of hate that people have towards Wall Street-type persons, still at the end of the day, if a homeless person who's generous of spirit and a wealthy person who's cold and detached both come into our church, I would wonder who we'd gravitate more towards and who we'd want to more quickly have be on our church committees, right? There's even been studies done. This is really creepy, and I actually have now verified this in several locations because I thought the first time I heard this was a lie. It can't be true. That they do these medial prefrontal cortex studies, which is the part of the brain where we recognize other human beings, right? So I'm looking at these faces in front of me, and I see you in my brain differently than I see an object. When showing people pictures of various human beings, they found that showing them images of people who are clearly homeless looking, that the vast majority of people looking at the images, no matter what their political or moral framework is, will see those homeless people as objects, not as persons. And they've studied this and they've determined it's because for us to determine whether or not someone is a human being, we do this quick analysis over how much capacity they have, how capable they are. Can they do something for me? That question. And how warm are they? So if we judge someone instantly as not being warm or capable, we will tend to see them as an object. And there's systemic reasons for why we do that. There's almost intentional ways that we do this as society when we're going to war with someone where we'll try to create the enemy as someone who's not quite human by saying, making them look cold and bumbling. We saw that in Japan. This is probably the clearest example of these propaganda pieces of people who are bumbling idiots who looked subhuman. That process of turning someone from a human being into an object is called infrahumanization. And our society, for some way, reason or another, has been effective at teaching us how to see the homeless as not quite human. So we have this belief that we're a meritocracy, where people who have the money deserve it. We have almost an instinctive aversion to homeless people, not seeing them quite as human beings. We also have a growing sense of what we feel we need to have in order to be healthy human beings. Like, living simply, it's been interesting for us as a community to explore living simply, because it's quickly apparent that my sense of what it means to live simply is different than someone who's 24, for example, right? So when we're figuring out stipends, as we're trying to move towards a common purse, the argument right now is how much of a monthly stipend do you need for a cell phone, right? For me, I had to be convinced that you needed to have a cell phone, but I'm like, you can get a $10 a month plan. I was like, no, we need to have at least $80 a month because you can't not have a smartphone today. So you have this growing sense of what you need in order to be a healthy, happy human being. You have this built-in judgment against homeless people. We have the sense of meritocracy. And so now when you start going to talking about how a church can do Jubilee, then it goes into the framework of stewardship, which is a word that sometimes at its best means we have to be very discerning about how money flows through us so we can do the most good with it. But oftentimes it becomes a form of economic control, where there's a group of people who have a vision and we want to control how the money's spent, and it makes sure it fits our needs and our vision. And so if someone else comes to us with a different sort of need, we don't share it with them, right? So there's all sorts of philosophical and structural reasons why doing Jubilee is hard. And I'm not sure what the answer to this is. We're also very busy people, so the idea of figuring out how to challenge a congregation to think about, I mean, if you look at any given congregation, I'm pretty sure most people in the congregation feel like they're strapped for cash. They feel like they're over busy. As pastors, we feel like we're pushing our people as hard as we can anyways, and we don't want to be jerks about it. So for us, it begins, that's why I think it's so important to start small instead of trying to change the whole system immediately. We can work for systemic change, but at the end of the day, if we're actually just doing hospitality and doing the small things so that it can grow, it creates more of an imagination overall for the systemic changes that we can make. And for me, the thing that's been helpful, this bit of spirituality I've learned from the Anabaptists as I've become a Mennonite, is this great term, Gelassenheit, right? Who knows what Gelassenheit is? This is much, I'm hoping that someone tell me like a little bit about, this is like an Anabaptist word, right? It's German. Come on. Nobody?
If we attempt to explain it, then we're not exhibiting Gelassenheit.
Well played, sir. So I understand it, and I'm trying to grapple with this idea. And I tend to interpret it a little differently than I think has been traditional within Anabaptism, but it's this idea of letting go-ness. And I think it's often tied with the idea of obedience. And this is, tell me if I'm wrong on this, that oftentimes the idea of Gelassenheit or letting go-ness is in relationship to someone, maybe someone telling you what to do. There's some of that sense, or at least being obedient to the rule of the community. And so I think there can be some gross pieces to that sometimes. But for me, this idea of Gelassenheit, of letting go of things, is helpful because for me, it's not so important that wealthy people have money taken from them and poor people have it given to them. That kind of way of, that kind of quick and easy sort of activistic shorthand isn't very helpful, because to me, at the end of the day, the only reason Jesus seems to be motivated towards for a Jubilee vision is so that people can enter into relationship with each other as brothers. Like this whole idea of Jubilee, especially you see this in Acts, isn't about vengeance or even just primarily about everyone having lots of good stuff for themselves. It's because they're a family now and family shares. So if you're not doing Jubilee, you're not acting like a family. So there's a relational piece that's the most important thing, right? So for me, the idea of Gelassenheit is important as someone who has more social capital and has probably still has more money than the guests who come to us. It's for me to recognize how I can use my resources in a way that brings us closer to each other, and being honest about the ways in which wealth separates. And that for me, a spirituality of Gelassenheit doesn't have to look into how much I deserve what I have and how much the other person doesn't deserve what they have, but simply asks, what can I do with the money now that I have, or all the resources, that brings us closer to each other, which takes the moralizing a little bit out of it, and instead, and doesn't seek to get points either. Instead, it just looks at the person in front of you and says, we're at this table together. This is the whole point of communion in some ways. And this is why the Apostle Paul gets upset and calls the people in Corinth, they accuses them of turning their Lord's Supper into a table for demons, is because some people with resources and some people with less resources were not actually encountering each other at the table, because the people with money were eating food from the poor folks came. Because the communion table is supposed to be about people really authentically coming together as family. So for me, when I gather at the table and think about gummy bears and soda, my first instinct should be, what can I do in this space that brings me closer to this other one without me having to think about whether or not I deserve gummy bears and soda? But how do I let go of the gummy bears and soda, which is hard? Because gummy bears are like little stress balls for your mouth. Like they take the tension of the week away. They're very chewy and delicious. And see, every time we gather as a community is a Eucharistic moment where the divisions fall. So when we gather for our Lord, every week when we do communion, we actually do an agape meal. It's a full meal deal. We gather around, and part of our liturgy, we ask, am I reconciled to everyone at this table, which is the traditional sort of question. We also ask, does anyone have a need here at this table that's within my power to meet? Just the economic question. And the third is probably the most, anything that I cling to that keeps me from offering love to everyone at this table. To me, that's the question that bridges the spiritual concern and the economic concern. And by living in that space, even people who have different economic views of our society can start seeing, you're right, maybe I do, I might deserve all this stuff. I deserve having lots of cars. I deserve having lots of stuff. I need to have a boat, a pontoon boat, and a speedboat. I need all these things. But I also recognize that love is the most important thing. So I'm willing to let go of some of these things if it draws me closer to the others at this table. And that can be done without condescension and without moralizing. Yeah. Am I reconciled to everyone at this table? Does anyone have a need at this table that's within my power to meet? And is there anything that I cling to that keeps me from offering love to everyone at this table? For us, it's very practical for us because I actually know or live with everyone at the table when I'm asking these questions. So it makes it very immediate. And I realize quickly that I don't have any, like, it's not abstract if I can look across and see the thing that keeps me from loving Martin is my judgments about his hygiene, right? And maybe the thing he needs is someone to help him wash up because he actually has some limited mobility. Or I can let go of my standard. But either way, something is keeping me from loving him. Or it could be economic. Right now, between our two houses, it's been an interesting journey because I didn't expect this to happen, but right now between our two houses, we have one vehicle. Everyone rides bike or buses or walks or shares that one vehicle. Us creating space and building relationship, the thing that my wife and I had to let go of, and this is probably, might regret this in the future, but we basically lost a lot of our livelihood, and one of our two community houses is in foreclosure right now, which is a bummer. The one Amy and I own is in foreclosure, so we basically have dispossessed ourselves in this process. But the community as a whole is stronger because we did that probably bad pastoral habit of transfusing your life energy into your church to keep it going kind of motion. We've all done that a little bit, I think. At some point, especially if you're a founder of a community. But after that process, and we kind of reformulated everything, and have been raising money to replace the house, we're doing fine. And I realized that even though there's some unhealthy reasons that I kind of heroically cast ourselves into this situation to try to fix our economic challenges as a community, the plus sides we found is that really our relationships with everyone is so much better because we're no longer the mom and pop of the community because we have the assets. We found that we're actually have, and it's been amazing, like folks who come to us as guests who used to have an attitude, it felt like to me, of disempowerment, like they're always holding back and waiting for something to happen to them, which I think is very institutional. As we've struggled with it together, now we're all working at it together. We have a strong sense of being in it together, and that anytime anybody gets resources, they tend to share. When people ask, do you have problems with guests who receive aid being stingy and like hoarding stuff? And I realize we've never had a problem with that. Our guests who come to us if they stay with us for more than 6 months or so, end up just sharing everything. It becomes very natural once you have a sense of vulnerability and trust for everything to be shared. And so it's been a good journey for us. One last little thing. And then how much time do we have? And
about half an hour.
And that's for Q&A and everything. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop there. I have more I could say, but I think I've given enough of a snapshot of our community and some of my reflections on Jubilee, and I think everything's still kind of in the utopian ether right now, so maybe we can have some Q&A around practicalities. Hopefully things that can be helpful for your context, because again, I recognize an intentional community context is not the same, right? So.
And we will ask you to use a microphone so we can pick up for the podcast, but you still need to speak out so the group can hear you. Please identify yourself.
This is Bob Walden. How long has your community been together?
We have a couple different ways of reckoning it, but it's about 10 years.
Okay, and so some communities after about 10 years are falling apart. It sounds like you're doing better than the typical.
No, we've had our crisis moments for sure, but I think we're actually very strong right now. We're actually, at the end of this month, we're closing on our new community house, which we're actually able to pay for in cash. We had to raise funds from outside the community, but also people within our community, even though we're all technically low income or lower, also put a lot into it. So it's been a good season for us.
Mike Ford, tell us a bit more about this weekly Agape Feast. Is your community one that practices weekly reconciliation, or does a lot of discussion happen in response to those three questions? And give us a few more details.
No, I mean, I think there's a little bit of guardedness. We haven't had any deep conversations happen around the table around those questions. Usually there's, the way it normally functions is the questions are asked and there's silence to reflect on them. And from there, usually happens afterwards. Like for me, for example, when I think of those questions, something comes to mind, and then so then I'll go up to someone afterwards and say, you know, I have this issue with you that I want to talk about, or I think about needs. And it's been, and I think it's, for we've only been doing the 3 months, so my hope is it kind of, like other practices that we've adopted, it sometimes takes a while for it to really seep into our DNA. But just in general, those sorts of questions, we tend to focus a lot of them practically on our weekly discernment meetings. Every Saturday we have a discernment meeting, which has a lot of silence. It's like a hybrid between it's almost like our business meetings, but there's a lot of times of silence and actual discernment, where when people have needs, it'll come up there and we'll start problem solving and discerning together. And it's been great to see the transition over time of people start being really honest about, like, I know pretty much what everybody makes in our community. They all know what I make. And people have become very honest about, hey, Brett, do you think, I know that you still tend to buy, you know, your craft beer every week. Do you think you could maybe use some of that money for this problem that's raised? And there's not much judgment anymore. I find that when you can be very vulnerable and take risks and keep the judgment out of it, the level of honesty can shoot up really quick, which is surprising. I'm from Minnesota. We're very passive-aggressive people. And so so I've been surprised at that, because that's not how I've societally functioned. Yep.
I'm Eva Kratz from Franconia. And how do you handle insurance? Medical and other insurances.
Can you repeat that? I'm
not sure. How do we handle insurance? Yeah, the question: how do we handle medical insurance? We've just basically left it to individuals to figure out how to get it, and we've encouraged people who make no money to sign up for Minnesota Care, which is like, now that the Obamacare stuff has kicked in, actually Minnesota Care, the structure is still in place because that structure is better than Obamacare. So now Obamacare funds, at some level, Minnesota Care. So really, what we do is just encourage people to sign up to get whatever care they can get. The question, as we move towards a common purse, which we're in the process of structuring it now, we're going to start with paycheck common purse, where everyone puts their money in and then everyone gets a stipend. But then eventually, we may move to a 501D status, which is like what the Jesuits have. Part of that process is we're trying to figure out how do we factor in things like insurance for folks who don't either can't qualify. Now with Obamacare, there'll be probably some sort of premium we'll have to help chip in to pay for, that sort of thing. So it's getting on a brass tacks for us right now in this season.
Wayne Nitschi, would you talk to us about your worship practices, please?
So like our Sunday night kind of worship service sort of thing? Our worship practices, we gather. We've experimented a bit over the years, but right now it's been pretty stable for the last couple of years. basically we gather, we have the space above the garage that we turn into an oratory, which we think it's funny because it's a space above a garage, but the word oratory is kind of a fancy word. So when people come and visit us in our oratory, they're a little bit confused at first. It's a nice space, but it's still a space above a garage. We gather there for a reading of the scripture of the week. We generally follow the lectionary for a time of singing, and then we have 25 minutes of silence, which is open worship in a Quaker sense. And then from there, we go downstairs, gather on the table, and we do our agape liturgy every week. And then we discuss around the table reflections we had from the passage during the silence, or just have more of the discussion time. And that's been a departure from the past where I was talking, like doing more of a formal talk. But we found that because we see each other a lot and are bumping into each other on common projects a lot, that a lot of the theological reflection stuff, I find ways to get it in there as kind of part of my charism. And then we have folks do some readings when they first come, that it works. I was anxious because I've always wondered how Quakers keep people from being raging heretics all the time, or whatever. But that's basically our structure. We also, at different times, we've had prayer times throughout the week. We gave up on the idea of a morning and evening prayers, which we started with, because us being a working class or lower type community, the work schedules are impossible to manage with that.
John Stolz, you mentioned having a five-year-old. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I have a five-year-old as well, and I'm really curious about, I see how my five-year-old sees what I do rather than listens to what I say in terms of,
Yeah, isn't that problematic? Yeah.
Well, and I'm really, I also work with I have a passion for youth and their faith development. What kind of, in your community, what does faith development look like for your children and your youth? And what are some of the things that you're seeing in their lives in terms of the impact that your community is having on them?
Yeah. I think we try to include Jonas as much as we can, but it's just hard with like a lot of the formal stuff. But to the extent that he can participate, we just include him. So he's around for all the meals. In prayer times, he's kind of at this age where he likes to interrupt prayer, mm-hmm. to say things that he thinks are funny, usually about poop. I just hope that stops sometime before he grows up. But there's for a lot of us, for us, it's been very important as a family to have just time, just the three of us as a family, set apart from the rest of the community. So he has a really developed sense of like we're a family, but then this is also a different sort of family. Like we try to categorize that. And then I spend a lot of time reading with him and processing things. And we try to do family consensus, which is hard still for five. We tend to do circles of consensus in our community, meaning that people participate in consensus to the level that things affect them, for the most part. So for example, like our weekly discernment meetings, all the residents, guests can request to join the meeting but aren't invited necessarily. But all the residents and members are part of our consensus meeting, but only members can block consensus. That's kind of how it works. So as we try to have little family meetings where we practice that ourselves, our own family decisions and things like that. But I think for him, he's mostly learning how to do hospitality well, which he, it's interesting. Some of the guests he calls stinky, and he's not really nice to the guests. No, he hasn't learned his empathy yet. But the thing that's been good for us to see with him is in terms of some of the practices we do as a community is how instinctive he is at including people. And how he often knows right off the bat, he's one of the first ones to notice when a guest seems, he's the first one to tell when a guest is probably not going to be able to stay with us for very long. He picks up on some kind of malevolence, I guess, from some of our guests who've come. And so I think just the ins and out of living together, and then also there's different people in our community that we entrust to watch him, but others everyone knows that there's people we'll ask to watch him, but that we're not just anybody can watch him. And we choose them largely also because there's different skills. The nice thing about living in communities, there's so much skills being shared. So Jonas gets involved in gardening and dumpster diving, which we had to talk through that one before he went dumpster diving. He can't go into the dumpster, but he can watch outside of the dumpster, for example. Things like that. All sorts of learning things that have been good. And he sits in our silence for as long as he can handle it, and when he stops being able to handle it, one of the adults in our community will go downstairs with him. So we're trying to train him for being able to make it through the whole time, which I'm assuming will happen somewhere by the time he's 30. Maybe he'll sit for 25 minutes.
I'm Ben Weidman. One of the challenges I see with the consensus model is that as the group grows, it becomes a lot more difficult to actually arrive at consensus. Do you see sort of a cap on how big your community can become? Is there going to be a sort of intentional split at a certain size, or do you just see it sort of remaining at its current size?
We haven't had to deal with that. We've never been large enough to where we felt it's a problem, so we haven't really thought about it too much. My only thought about the Quaker, you can have large Quaker meetings where they make business, but I think it's about defining the parameters of what things fall under consensus or not. I think probably becomes the big issue. So we have noticed a shift in what sort of things we process in our discernment meetings. And then really then I think it's become a little bit more about figuring out how to nurture a particular culture so that we don't have to safeguard as much during our discernment meetings, and then allow discernment. So for us, discernment meetings tend to happen about very practical things. We don't really talk as much about philosophical decisions anymore. So I think that's been some of the trade-off. I don't know. If we'd become big fast, it probably wouldn't have worked out for us very well to do consensus, I think.
Bob Walden, is your community racially or ethnically diverse, or and if so, does that, is there some dynamics, or if not, why not?
Yeah, not as much as we'd like. There's some diversity, but we're aware of the fact that a lot of our diversity has come through hospitality, which brings its own, it's an awkward ickiness to it. If you have white people giving hospitality to people of color, there's a power dynamic there that's kind of strange. So for us, part of the dynamic what that reminds us is that we have to think about hospitality in a non-condescending way and more as a justice practice, so that we're somehow feeling like us offering hospitality to folks and including folks isn't a nice thing that we do and we get points for, but it's part of our process of repentance. I think it's good for white people, like a lot of these intentional communities are very white. There can be a problem when folks just try to fix that by becoming diverse instead of noticing, like, why is it that white people are so broken that they need intentional communities so much, is maybe the question that we try to ask. What are we relearning? And how does it give us a sense of humility about how, what do you think our goal is? For our goal as a community is not to live in community. It's to see community as a way for us to learn how to be a certain sort of person that can start doing Jubilee and live a certain way. So when people come to us, we don't really try very hard to get them to stay long term. Our only goal is to ruin them for normal life. Like, that's what right? And this is an important piece, and it's an argument that I end up having a lot of with intentional communitarian folks who think that the goal is community, like living in an intentional community. The problem is when you have that, your instinct is going to be to squelch dissent, because the unity of the collective is the most important. If that's your most important value, when someone, a person of color, ends up having criticisms, the temptation is to silence them. And so we look at it as we try to build relationships with other groups that have shared radical values, particularly with communities of color, so that we're seeing ourselves as an intentional community is not a better form of doing things than the Korean Presbyterian Church we do stuff with, but this is our process of learning how to get to the same things they're getting at so that we can come together and in solidarity and work on common things. And so that's how we try to look at it. We are eager to have guests of ours come and become full members, and if diversity comes from that, which it has a little bit, not a lot, we're happy for it, but we still try to keep it non-heroic and humble about why we're living in communities, because there's something broken in us.
Thank you.
You've talked about keeping the judgment out of it when you confront each other on something. How has that happened, or are there like spiritual formation practices, or I mean, how do people learn how to keep the judgment out of it? I'm really curious.
For us, I don't know. I feel like what practically ends up happening is, when you're doing discernment, for example, there's a number of practices about discernment. It's not just people sitting in a room and deciding things together. Typically, you're supposed to have someone, we don't always formally assign someone for this, you have someone who's facilitating the meeting, but then there's the person who checks the temperature, as it were, who's noticing anxieties. And oftentimes, someone in our community, when you can kind of tell when an anxiety is coming from problem-solving mode, and like, we need to figure this, because this is important to us. And a place of judgment, like, that person keeps on, like, we have someone who is a long-term guest who's kind of been, who, not a traditional guest, because they don't need to live with us. We were doing them a favor so they could look for work, but they could move back to where they came from and be with their family. And they're from a middle-class background. And so there was becoming a lot of judgment for us about how he's taking up space that we could give to someone who really needs it. And so the judgment started creeping in, and we noticed people were starting to say, well, we can just move his stuff. We don't even have to ask. He's overstayed, like that kind of thing. Like it become. So then the reminder comes, look, what's the most loving thing right now for him and for us? We can't do it for him. We can only be honest with him out of love. We can't take away his agency. That'd be wrong. We can be more honest and direct, but we have to discern now what is the loving thing we're asking. And so it became clear that there's this, we know where judgment is coming here, and if we keep going, we know what's going to happen. And so pausing and taking time to unknot it, and then usually there's one person who is just less anxious who's able to notice that a bunch of other people are getting freaked out, and they call attention to it. And then you can't, since it's consensus is required for some of these things, you can't just move past it. And so that's really where it comes. It's in the kind of the minutia of those details. And I've personally found that my ability to not judge as quickly has come from me being able to be more transparent about my problems and not feeling judged. So I think there's a cumulative effect of trust. Like for me, I've had to work through my own stuff, and then it makes me much more gracious towards other people, and I can notice it. So it's just time and intentionality.
That out with him, is that done with him present? I mean, is that
sometimes, like if you're a guest and we're in a consensus meeting, like part of it, we it's okay if we talk about people behind their backs as long as we're trying to figure out how we as a collective are going to approach something. It's very tricky because you can easily get into gossipy, gross things. So it's also about keeping track of that. But then usually one or two persons. We'll go say, well, like, listen, we processed. We don't start the like, we failed when we start that process without telling them that the process is happening. Okay. I think you need to tell people, like, we're going to be talking about this. I want you to give you a heads up, and if you want, have somebody say, we need to talk about it ourselves for a bit. At some point, if you want to talk to us as a whole group, we can. That's important. We've skipped over that before, and it's hurt feelings. But then in the end, it's also, I've had to let go of my aversion to conflict, because I think there's this myth, I think Mennonites, we struggle with this, but also like in Scandinavian Minnesota, we struggle with this too, where we think conflict is a bad thing that has to be avoided. And I've gotten to the point where I've given myself permission to get upset with people in a more candid way, like, which is hard. And just really being present in that and not trying to shortcut, just really letting all the problems be there and seeing them for what they are and working through them all and not shortcutting it because it's awkward. I mean, I think that's a big piece of it too.
We have about 5 minutes if there are more questions.
Ben Wideman, another practicality question maybe. I think in addition to the cell phone debate, the millennial generation's probably also carrying a lot of debt, especially educationally. How does that get navigated in intentional community when you've got a stipend?
The thing we're factoring in is when with new people who come, we're trying to figure out how much debt they're bringing with them, and that's a factor if they're wanting to join our community and our discernment. Folks we have now, it's going to work out because they have to be paying back their school loans at some point, and they have kind of income, outcome, expense, and mostly living with a stipend and on a common purse limits the amount of discretionary income people have. So if they're able to pay it now without going into deeper and deeper debt, well, it's fine. That's kind of how that works out. I also have been, I've also been giving more and more people advice to not do college right away, which is kind of heresy. But we all know it's not, the number of educated people I know who work for Jimmy John's or Pizza Hut is huge. And they're not getting the jobs over and against other people who don't have college. So when we have opportunity to talk to younger people who haven't done college, we'll often explore, kind of like the way that Quakers and Mennonites sometimes do explorations for alternatives to service. We do that same kind of approach for college because college, you know, you don't want to end up being a debt slave right out of college and not being able to do anything, the things you want to do to serve Jesus, you know. So that's part of it too.
Perhaps we can end on this unique bit of curiosity. Could you elaborate on dumpster diving, please?
Yes.
And what it means to your community.
It's a way of getting food for free. That's what it, it's industrial gardening. No, we get food from a number of sources. We do some gardening. It's never, it always feels sad when harvest season comes because we'll like, look at these tomatoes. And then somebody who lives in a farm's like, hey, can I bring by some tomatoes? Yeah, and they're like, boom, like this huge amount of tomatoes. Like, why did we spend all this time gardening, right? So we get food from that, we buy groceries, but then, especially in the winter, dumpster diving makes all kinds of sense because it's basically a freezer in Minnesota. And so you go, you can, if you know the routes, you know when the stuff gets thrown out, like you can tell when stuff has just been in the dumpster for an hour or two. You can see, oh, it just expired today, that's why they threw it out. So you know, like, this is worth eating. And so that's where we get our most premium stuff. Go to Trader Joe's and get, the problem is people have to, I didn't realize how dumb people can be with dumpster diving. Because I feel like some of this is generational. Like I know where food comes from and I know the internal checking temperature of meats and all that kind of stuff that I feel like you're supposed to know. So when people come home and they're eating sushi that they dumpster dove, like, what? That doesn't make any kinds of sense. Like, well, if I get sick, well, no. I'm like, that's not how you make that decision. So for us, dumpster diving is this, it's a practice that young people come, like, I'm like, it's just free food that's kind of gross. That's all that dumpster diving is. But it's great. We try to go to places before they throw it out. Most places aren't willing to do that because they're just afraid of liability. So then we help liberate their conscience by just taking it. This seems like a no-brainer for us. And we try to pick safe things and healthier things. Cheese is great. You can just cut off the edges, right? This thing's just knowing those sorts of stuff.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for being with us today, for sharing your story, your heart, your vulnerability, as you started out saying, your failures. But I think you're doing some really kingdom work up in Minnesota, and it's a privilege to have you with us today. Thank you. I want to highlight just a couple of things that are coming up. I hope you all have November 2nd on your calendar for our fall conference assembly. That will be an important part of our community life together, and we have some important, though maybe not easy, conversation to have with one another. And so I really encourage you to be holding this time together in a posture of prayer as we anticipate it, that we can have an honest, and my goal, and I don't think this is setting the bar too high, is that we can be more civil with one another than our U.S. Congress. So as Christians, I think we ought to be able to meet that goal. I also want to remind those of you that are credentialed leaders that, and you will be getting your form right after conference assembly, but we will be having a dinner for credentialed leaders and a guest at Souderton Mennonite Homes on Tuesday, December 3rd, 6:15. We will be serving hors d'oeuvres. The Souderton Mennonite Homes culinary staff is very excited to have a fancy meal to prepare for you, and I think it will be a very nice time, a nice dinner, and a nice program. So I hope any of you that are credentialed leaders will be able to join us for that. There are a few things kind of wiggling around in the works for pastors and leaders breakfasts come next year, but nothing firm to announce right now. But Bob Walden has some fresh information about the Peace and Justice Retreat, and I've invited him to share a few words about that.
Thank you, Gay. I have a few brochures for our something like 43rd annual Winter Peace Retreat at Spruce Lake, coming up at the middle of February. The topic this year is conflict resolution, which is maybe is timely given the state of our Congress. But with Ron Hertzler, who's been teaching for many years at Christopher Dock, and Laurie Hershey, West Philadelphia Mennonite Fellowship, last year West Philly went through a process of discerning how they would deal with membership for people of different sexual orientation. And the weekend will include some role-playing and some interactive games. So I have a few brochures today, and we'll have more at the conference session in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Bob. I have invited Luke Martin to sing today, if you'll rise.
Lord, we thank you for the Spirit of Jesus among us this morning, and we pray that your Spirit would guide us in our thoughts and actions today, the coming days, that we may be able to practice more effectively, more lovingly, the call to Jubilee. Continue to bless Mark and the Mennonite worker community and all of us as we seek to be faithful to Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen.